Tim, you and I have been working in software sales for a while now, right? So partners have often been a part of the picture, and from our perspective, mostly to implement the projects or maybe to bring the initial lead to us.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And the thing is, obviously, both of us, we work in pre-sales, and for us, the exposure to partner management is limited, I would say. So it's a good reason to take a deeper look into the topic. Sales Excellence, this is your podcast for software, B2B sales, and pre-sales. My name is Tim, and I'm a solution consultant at Exactly.
And I'm Jan, a pre-sales leader at SAP. Welcome to a new episode of our podcast.
Yeah, so as we said in the beginning, of course, Jan and myself work in pre-sales. So how dare we talk about partner management? And in fact, we don't. Hence, we have invited a guest. And our guest today, he brings over 20 years of experience in sales and partner management, predominantly in US blue chip companies such as Salesforce, for example, for 7 years. And now most recently, he joined UiPath. Mark Schuster, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Hi. Good afternoon on a Friday afternoon, of all things.
Indeed, indeed. Thanks for joining us. And maybe we can start right there. So you have spent multiple years in sales and in partner management. And from my observation, there is certainly some similarities, but also some distinct things. In your view, having experienced it both, what's really the difference between the two?
Great question. So being in sales, and it doesn't matter, you can also be in sales and partner management. My role at the moment is not just channel manager, but I also have a sales role in that sense. I think the biggest difference for the both are in sales, it's really, you're the account manager, you're in front of your client. While in the partner management, you're swimming. You're trying to be the best friend at the big global system integrator, while you're trying to build up the small little boutique partner. And you're much, I would say, from my experience, much more politically on the go. Obviously, when you're an account manager, there's a lot of politics too, from a direct perspective. But I think being in a partner management role is you need to look at the entire ethos of what it is if you are selling in the indirect way. Which a lot of software companies and a lot of SaaS companies are doing. So that I think that's the big difference there.
Hmm. So obviously in sales, you're being measured by closed deals, right? That's typically the metric that everyone is chasing for. So does it translate to partner manager? You have brought a new partner on board. Is that already your goals? Is that what you're aiming for?
Yeah. I mean, so for the last few companies that I've been with, I mean, one of the big ones is obviously having a country goal. So being part of the team and bringing a big revenue number, and also onboarding partners is a big thing. I give you the example here at UiPath where I've started is we had a very small amount of partners here locally in Switzerland. And it was really, really, you know, in the hyper growth that we are in, it was very important to find the right partner right away. So there can even be, you know, I would say targets on partners on onboarding and also enablement. Let's not forget enablement. I think enablement is one of the big things in actually making sure that pre-sales leaders like Jan and yourself, Tim, that you can actually use those partners because, you know, we want to make sure as partner managers that we are really getting the best out of our partners. And you as pre-sales are very, very important in making them also believe in whatever product you're selling.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I think onboarding is definitely a topic we should also dig deeper into, and especially also the role of pre-sales within that enablement, because right. I think Jan and myself, we have very distinct experiences in that regard. Before we go there, I'm sorry, Jan, I'm aware I interrupted you. But just a quick one in between. So you said you want to be the best friend of those big system integrators. I don't know, maybe something like Accenture, Deloitte, whoever's out there, right? Whoever's doing IT projects. But at the same time, you say you also want to make sure you acquire those specialized boutique partners. Is that something that sort of pulls you in both directions? Because I'm assuming partners, obviously, preferably to have the business, but then the question becomes, who do I give it to if there really is a project to be implemented?
Absolutely. I mean, I take the example over here at UiPath, where, you know, we started with a small base, a very boutique partner ecosystem, but to scale, and I think you guys know that at the companies that you're at, if you want to achieve hypergrowth, you want to be in the big, big projects, the GSI is one of the most important aspects of that. And there's many, many different ways of how you can build that up. You know, interesting enough, in channel management, I was doing a little bit of research before for this podcast. There's not very much material on channel management from a software perspective. So a lot of it is also learned in the daily doing. But the GSI part is definitely one of the sticky ones that, which will get your company to hypergrowth.
GSI refers to those big global software system integrators.
Exactly. The global system integrators, like you said, the Accentures, the Deloittes, the Capgeminis. And they're the ones that have, you know, the COEs, right? They're the ones that have actually the big groups of people. I look at RPA, robotic process automation, or hyper automation, as we like to call it now. And, you know, a lot of these groups have their dedicated centers, and you need to be present in them. So, you know, a lot of the models that some of these software companies are doing is they're saying, hey, look, we'll have a dedicated partner director for Accenture. We'll have a dedicated one for Deloitte. And then on a regional basis, you'll have a partner manager like myself who will be obviously, you know, making sure that he's got that relationship regionally. But you also have somebody in the background which will take care of the COEs. And those are kind of the guys that I believe also pre-sales managers and directors like yourselves will also be talking to, because these are the guys that are doing the real placement.
My point was basically I couldn't agree more on onboarding and enablement. I think it's really mission critical, right, to make sure it will be successful and it will support, for example, the hypergrowth model you guys are running with your company at the moment.
Right.
And on the rest, like, I mean, onboarding and enablement, I guess, is the starting point. I would say there is much, much more to really make it work and valuable, but we will dig into that later.
Yeah, so just before we come to that, maybe it's a bit of a naive question that I want to come to next, but why do we need partners anyway?
Yeah.
What's the fundamental reason why, especially tech companies say, okay, we need a partner landscape? And I think one part of the answer you've given already is scalability, right?
Scalability, right.
But maybe there's a bit more to it in your view. What do partners really bring to the table?
I mean, let's be honest. Software, anything and everything in software that I've sold in the last 20 years, I'm always saying the same thing. Software needs to be like water. It needs to flow. It needs to get out to every aspect of the business. And the only ones that are really knowing which these businesses are doing are actually the partners, the people that are putting in the big blade servers when I remember when I was at Dell, or putting in the storage systems when I was at NetApp, or even at Salesforce. We relied very heavily on those partners that are on a day-to-day basis in those accounts. And the real mission for a software company is to obviously sell its licenses at the end of the day. And of course, we have models like the customer success manager, you know, who's doing the after sales, which is also supposed to be kind of the beacon to know, hey, what the problems or what the challenges are. But if you really look at it, honestly, software is here to be consumed. And the SaaS model has really, you know, I mean, in the years that we've been in the business, it's just normal for us, SaaS. It used to be, you know, coming in boxes. I remember when I was at Microsoft many, many years ago. Okay, I'm not that old, but, you know, floppies as well, right? But, you know, at the end of the day, a software company is here to sell their software. And you need the partner to be actually holding the hand of that client because he's going to be doing the real day-to-day. Obviously, you've got the exceptions, the big accounts, you know, like the Nestle's, the Novartis, that say, hey, look, you know, we bought this and this from you. You need to make sure that your team is giving the stamp of approval. So, of course, you have that from the vendor side, which will be doing that. But usually you will have, you know, a GSI for a big one, or you'll have a specialized partner, which will be really kind of holding the hands. Because at the end of the day, I mean, we're all saying that, you know, software is really eating up the world. That's nice and right. But, you know, there's still somebody that still has to install it. And that's something that, I don't know, Benioff sometimes, he might forget.
Yep.
But he's done a great job, I got to say, with his partnerships. He really turned the game around.
Absolutely. I mean, I think Salesforce specifically is quite known for their very expansive partner network. So, and you mentioned one thing just now. Someone has to implement it. Obviously, partners, that's one area of work they would be doing. What I've observed multiple times in years in the past is that there's sometimes also a bit of an area of conflict, right? Because most software vendors, they also have professional services teams. And those professional services teams, they have sometimes also dedicated service sales roles. So people that are being incentivized by selling professional services, right? And then you come to the question of utilization, right? So maybe sometimes those PS teams are not always at 100% capacity. And then you have a deal on the table, maybe in a local environment where a certain language and a culture is necessary, where you maybe even have a partner available. And all of a sudden, you have one set of the company saying, well, we want to utilize our PS resources. And then you have the customer on the other side who wants to have, obviously, preferably a local partner with a local language, with a knowledge and so on. And all of a sudden, you as an account manager sit in the middle and say, okay, well, which route to go? Have you observed that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I can say that with some of the last few companies that I've been with is, you know, a lot of the revenues, if you look at, you know, their numbers on the stock exchange, a lot of these companies, they're not allowed to do more than 10 to 15% of their overall revenues in services. So we have, you know, certain companies out there, software companies that are saying, look, you know, it can only be for the top clients that we have. And I completely agree with you. There are certain software companies out there that will give these service leader roles, that will give them a number. But from what I've seen from the hypergrowth companies that I've been in, it's really such that they have really, really, really relied on the partners. And of course, you know, there are always the big, I would call them the gigantic customers out there who want that approval from the vendor. But it's all done in relation to company size. So you won't have like a company doing, you know, 50% of its revenues just on services.
Yeah. And listening to you, Mark, to me, it's like also being focused on what you're really doing, right? So as a software vendor, you should develop great software.
Absolutely.
And as you said, sell it. And especially in these hypercross environments, from my experience, you could never scale if your goal would be, okay, we also do all the implementation and all the services, right? You couldn't hire enough people and you couldn't hire them fast enough. And I think it's also great to have that partner network, not only to implement your product. I think if you give them the trust and if you really give that push to the partner network, they will also really help you to extend your product and develop your product further, because they will making all these experience, right? They can circle back and you can make it part of your product, or you give them kind of another opportunity to earn money because they starting developing add-ons to your platform, something like that, right?
Absolutely. I think that's a great point, especially with the marketplaces. I look at UiPath, I look at the marketplace that they have out there, connections into, you know, the ServiceNow, Salesforce, SAP areas of this world. They're doing it for free. There's other ones like Salesforce where they have a mix of free and paid. But it's a great way of also extending that ecosystem. And you touched upon a good point around the commission, especially also with SaaS companies for partners. You know, usually they're just getting the first year of a multi-year deal, for instance, in a commission. That's also something to think about. I remember we had some discussions some years back when, for instance, Microsoft in their partner program would be pushing more for their sales to to do on-premise, and you know the partner will be getting 30% of the overall deal, while you were pushing a software as a service product where the partner was only getting 10% of the so-called annual contract value of the first year. So, you know, do $1 million. The one guy gets 300,000. The other one gets much, much less. Very difficult. But I think that's where software as a service has really changed the game, right? To really spend the time on what they really need to be using. Yeah.
Just one clarification question, because especially on that part of incentives, which we have discussed a couple of times here already on this podcast, especially when you talk about the transition from on-premise to cloud, you have to design it in a really smart way. Otherwise, you will create conflict of interests. But what you just said is that when a partner is assisting within a project, my assumption was always, so really honest question here, my assumption was always that the partner is basically earning money via implementing the project. Like services cost, the consulting cost, that result of implementing the project would be how they earn their money. But now you're talking also about that they earn share of the SaaS subscription.
They do, yeah. They definitely do. So I can, you know, talk about UiPath quickly. We have the so-called deal registration process where the partner will get 15% off. And then, you know, the nice thing is because you want to scale, you'll get an extra 10% because it's a new customer. You can read about this. This is online on our partner guide. So yeah, you know, the partner is really, really interested not just to sell his services, but also the software company is giving something back. There are some other bigger SaaS players out there which don't completely believe in that. But in the automation world, from what I'm seeing is, you know, there is a definite way of giving back. And that's also very, very attractive, right? We say, you know, for instance, that, you know, whenever a license is sold, that what the partner is actually making, they always give it, you know, factor two or factor three. In automation, we're seeing, you know, factor four to factor five at the moment.
Interesting. And I think there are kind of different models, right? So Mark, as you said, one thing would be, okay, you can partner with us and you will earn the consulting revenue and these kind of things. What you're referring to also is like a reseller model or kind of referral fee if you bring that customer and we close the deal. So, and as you said, I mean, from my experience also, there are kind of different models. My feeling is you guys at your iPass, you really push it over the top, right, in that respect.
Thank you. I think also to add to that, there's also very different models. We've seen even models with so-called sales agents. So actually having, you know, influential, they're not partners, but influential people within an industry, which will bring in leads. And let's say this is a little better than just doing, you know, the cold calling that we were used to when we started our career in sales.
B2B influencers, so to say, yeah. But they don't hang out on Instagram, they hang out on LinkedIn probably.
Yeah, exactly. But they are an amazing asset to our digital lead qualification. And this is also another way of you know, these SaaS companies getting in and making sure that they're getting the right influencers.
Mm. So one other thing was burning on my mind in regards to general partner setup and maybe strategy. And I know that Salesforce is doing specifically, maybe also UiPath, and happy to hear of an example, but there seems to be certain categories, right? Never mind the fact that you have different types of partners. Maybe some are sourcing leads, some are doing implementation, some are doing the consultancy work. There's also like a categorization in terms of, okay, you're a silver partner, platinum partner, diamond, whatever. Right. What's the point of these type of levels? What does it really mean?
I mean, it's, I guess, a little bit to show the love for the partners. What I mean by that is, let's take a small boutique partner, which only has 2-3 people. He will usually have this so-called silver status. His prerequisites, so the certifications, what he needs to do will be obviously much, much lower than somebody that is in a gold or a platinum. I've seen at the SaaS companies, I've seen everything from, hey, you need to pay us, I don't know, let's say something like $10,000 a year to be part of our program, to a program like a UiPath where I'm at right now, where they're saying, hey, it's free of charge to get into the program. But I think the point of the whole exercise, why that's silver, gold, and platinum, is such to see what the real investment is of those partners. And obviously you'll have the GSIs, which will have the bigger part, but there's also that investment grade and that time of material that they're really spending.
Okay. Yeah, so that makes sense. Because that's one thing I was always quite curious about. And I want to really pick up on the point that you just made, because now depending on your presence in the market and the brand you have in the market and how fast you want to grow and where you stand on that path, so to say, sometimes it might be quite strange to go to a partner and say, hey, I want to charge you $10,000 so you can actually participate in my onboarding, because maybe you rely more on them than they rely on you.
Right? True. Yeah, true. But it's also a way of making money. I mean, look at some of the bigger SaaS companies and the gargantuous events that they produce. That's a money-making machine right there.
Yeah, it's almost a business model on its own. And that being said, I think it's a really fine line to walk, because, I mean, again, if I come back to a company such as Salesforce, yes, they are known in the market. They have huge leverage, and probably there's many companies out there, small boutique consultancies that would be extremely happy to be part of their partner network. And then you have maybe smaller companies, maybe below 100, maybe below 1,000 employees or something, that are still very much on a growth path. And then there's something in between. And I've sort of seen smaller companies that are still have that way of thinking, no, we want our partners to pay for the training. And in my view, oftentimes that was too early or not the right moment to charge for it.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the things. I mean, one of the things that we're doing locally here at UiPath is our CEO also believes in the democratization of robotic process automation, of hyper-automation.
Yes.
And basically, you know, you go into UiPath Academy, you do the courses for free, and everybody's happy. There's one course which is payable with Pearson, but it's just making sure that, like SaaS, you know, it's something that needs to be used. And you need to get that knowledge out there as fast as possible. So these platforms to actually educate partners and make it as free and as easy as possible, that should be the goal of all these SaaS companies for their growth.
And I think it's also kind of, maybe it should be part of the strategy, right? So, I mean, if I listen to you, Mark, I hear, so there's a clear strategy and partners and they are a fundamental part of your business model and all that stuff. And as Tim said, if kind of maybe smaller companies or grow up companies, maybe playing in a niche, saying, okay, you can partner with us, but give us money first. I don't feel that sounds like that they have a plan, right? Because if I listen to you, you guys see it as an investment, very valid investment into your own future. And you're going that direction. If I would be maybe a well-known partner in the market and I have all these resources, as Tim said, the vendor would need me much more than I would need the vendor, right? And if then someone is telling me, yeah, hey, I'm the partner manager here, so give us $10,000 and then we can talk. Not sure if that would work, right?
Sure.
All right. So now, since we are talking about this onboarding bit and we sort of briefly touched upon it a bit earlier, now let's go in, right? So you said earlier, pre-sales can play a role in that onboarding. And maybe I can biographically also tell a small anecdote of I've seen that in the past where I was in the pre-sales position. And then, of course, at the employer, there was a partner network. And then all of a sudden it's like, okay, Tim, there's a new partner. Why don't you give them like a 2-hour presentation or maybe like a full day workshop even, right? And where I'm like, okay, my role is pre-sales. I need to close deals. So why are you even involving me in this? Why is this happening, Mark?
Yeah, I think, I mean, a lot of organizations, when they start, you know, this indirect route, so going through the partner, they don't realize that actually they need somebody like a pre-sales person to be actually just dedicated for partnerships. And I have some great examples of some of the companies that I've been with where this has not been the case. It's great to have a partner manager running around. But at the end of the day, like you're saying, Tim, you want to have a focus. And one of the big things that we're doing at UiPath, for instance, is we do have a dedicated session with our new partners. But this is also coming from them, making them be very, very focused on what they want to learn. And there is always somebody that they can reach out to. So, you know, it doesn't matter if at UiPath, for instance, we have a forum. So an online forum where partners can go on, But you need also a person physically to also do these trainings. I'll give you an example. One of our biggest GSIs, we're going to their kickoff next week here in Zurich. And you won't believe it, right? You've got to know your audience. So this is all technical people. And they want to have not just a partner manager. I mean, I'm obviously also a technology fan and everything, but they also want somebody who's doing the doing, who's helping them with some of the cases. So you definitely need to plan the pre-sales, we call them technical partner managers, into the mix.
Yeah, and it comes back to the original question, right? Because we've noted that there's quite a few similarities between sales and partner management, which means the skill set and the type of personality that you have in that type of role is clearly quite distinct to what typically would sit in a pre-sales type of capacity. Yeah, so
right.
You can't expect the partner manager to be so technically deep in as your average pre-sales person. Yeah? So that technical partner pre-sales role that you just mentioned, I mean, that's new to me. I've never heard that before, but I can certainly see the need why, especially the bigger the organization gets, the more useful such a role would become.
Right.
All right. So maybe we can talk a little bit now about, we've labeled it expectation management, right? And I think to some extent we've already touched on it, because I think fundamentally as part of the enablement of partners, there's sort of like a chicken and egg problem, right? Businesses want to grow, but they also see that educating partners, especially if it's a longer thing, and for example, at Exactly, I know our partner initial track is like 4 weeks. It's quite a substantial investment from our side, but also from the partner side. But you don't want to do it if there is no promise of business at the end, of course, right? Otherwise, you're just spinning your wheels. How can companies identify partners that have a promising future, so to say? Is there like a recipe that you maybe use?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big things that I did, look at who those technology partners are. So where does the real doing? I looked at the Microsofts of this world that have a tight partnership. UiPath is, you know, done on .NET. And then I started identifying who were some of the partners within their ecosystem that could help us the best. That's something that I've done locally. That would be something that I would definitely suggest to anybody that is, you know, thinking about how to identify those bigger partners. So we have the technology partners. And second, what I would totally say to you is make sure that at the top of the triangle of the partners that you're looking at, make sure that you are talking to the strategy consultants. So make sure that you're talking to the Bostons, the McKinseys, the Roland Bergers. These are the people that are shaping the strategy at the top of the pyramid. And these are also the people that also know of some of the partners which are within some of these bigger customers. So definitely make sure that you're talking to the strategy people when you are looking at a focused view on getting new partners into your ecosystem.
Nice. So now I have one more question to you, and we didn't really discuss this beforehand, but I have to challenge you a little bit. You've mentioned UiPath a couple of times, and of course you see this acronym RPA, Robotic Process Automation. It's a bit off topic now, but I'm really keen. What's the elevator pitch for Robotic Process Automation?
So we have this term called reboot work. And basically, I mean, Tim and Jan, you guys know it all too well, right? You love to go to work. You don't like to do the admin, the small things, the approvals and such. And what RPA at the base has done is kind of bring out this mundane, boring administration that you're doing and kind of automating those processes so that Jan and Tim, that you guys can actually do what you like doing best. And that is, you know, being at the forefront of pre-sales and helping your customers and living those values. So RPA is one of the, I would say, the building blocks, kind of Lego building blocks. But as you probably know, Gartner has come out with this new term called hyper-automation. And basically what UiPath is doing is they're doing an end-to-end automation. Products like, you know, process mining, so actually identifying processes which need to be then automated, is at the very, very front. Also, you know, this great idea which, you know, customers like PwC, I can say officially, they're doing citizen-led development. So just imagine Jan and Tim, you guys are the masters of pre-sales. You guys know of different processes which you'd like to have changed within SAP or Exactly. wouldn't it be great if you could just like a Facebook sort, you could actually put it into a tool and then actually put that into a forum where, you know, you could actually have that process done and then actually in a later phase have that actually automated. I think really the citizen-led development, this is really getting more into the guts of the companies. So the real people that are into their craft, they're the ones that that are going to be changing the game. And for a knowledge worker like you and I mean, that is the best thing, right? We don't want to do tedious, mundane tasks. We want to be, you know, pushing with our customers to get the big customer success. So that that's for us very, very important part of getting actually the knowledge worker to do what he loves. Let's sell.
I can buy into that. Less admin, more focusing on the stuff that really counts. Yeah. So with that said, I would hand over to Jan. I don't know if you have any further questions to Mark or if you want to bring us to the real-time conclusion of today.
No, I mean, first of all, I think it's great that we have a partner manager today with us who really knows what his company is doing. So that's great. And second of all, I think we missed one part. And let me try to explain. So we talked about onboarding and enablement and all these things. Tim mentioned at his company, there's that 4-week investment to bring the guys up to speed. But what happens after the initial enablement, right? So let's say enablement is done and you guys know the stuff and we go with you to customers. So I think there is a lot more stuff. So things like how to keep the partners up to date, right? Because we are in the SaaS industry, we're doing a lot of releases, these kind of things. Then how can partners really show what your company is doing, right? So do they need their own demo systems? How easily they can get all that stuff? By the way, how expensive it is for the partner. So, I mean, I can imagine a lot of hurdles related to costs and maybe further investments you need to be done to really be in the position to pitch, right? And to really help as a partner to sell it to the end customer. So let's say after the onboarding and thinking about what else do they need in respect of technology and systems and accounts and whatever. So how do you face that kind of challenge?
Right. So very good question. So we started with, you know, the starting of building up that partner, then emerging, really getting to run with that partner. So we've enabled him. Now the next step is the so-called acceleration. So the acceleration in the channel process is really about putting the numbers on paper, doing the business plans, making sure that the approvals from the management is there to review on a quarterly basis. I'll give you the example. We have cadence with our so-called global system integrators every 2 weeks. Or we will have a regional partner which will say, look, you know, every quarter we want to make sure that we hit these points. If that's pipeline creation, if that's certification. There's a few metrics that you can use. I have, through some of the people that I've been working with, especially a company called Successful Channels, which I've seen online, they say, you know, plan it out. Get the right tools in action. So there's also a partner software out there, but it can also be done very, very easy on an Excel or a PowerPoint. But you definitely need to, in that acceleration modus, you need to make sure that you're also putting also activities in. I think one of them that we missed was MDF, so the marketing monies, which these companies have. That is also a very important part. Give you the example of so-called speed datings, which can take place, which is a great way of the sales to get to know the business partners. And then I think it's a process which always continues, very circular. And I think the partner manager is he's the guy in the orchestra that is really making sure that all the pianos and all the violins, that they're all tuned right. But that should be his big thing that he should do. And not forgetting, at the end of the day, not forgetting who his internal customers are, which is sales management, and being aligned to them. Because channel management only exists with sales management. That's something that I've learned many, many times over. You need to have the sales in the lead, but you as the channel also need to craft the strategy around how the business looks in the next 12, 24, 36 months.
Understood. And maybe one more technical question, right? So you said hyper growth mode. So the company is growing, the customer base is growing. You guys are earning a lot of money. The partner network is growing.
I'm not earning a lot of money. The others are earning a lot of money, not me.
All right. So there's room for improvement for you. I got that. So the more partners you acquire for your company, I would assume the more you need to invest into these partners, right? Time-wise, resources, but also kind of infrastructure and technology, if you would like to give your technology to them. So how big is that part, right? Is that, do you see that as an investment, or you say it's there anyway because it's SaaS and we don't really care? So how do you handle that kind of technology infrastructure stuff you need to have available for your partners?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think, you know, partner planning and performance management tools, they are needed. Let's not forget our partner marketing people. You definitely need to have them part of the mix to show what kind of leads, to show what kind, you know, what is the real ROI on these events. Never talk to marketing without knowing what the ROI is, from what I've learned. But yeah, you need also the learning management systems, which come there. So there's a bunch of different technologies which are needed. I've worked obviously more on the regional levels, but I can tell you from an HQ level, if those systems are not there after a while, like you're saying, you have gotten those partners, you need to feed them. That could be, you know, a part where there's some discrepancies. I think one of the nice things is, you know, make sure that you get visualization tools that, you know, your partner, when he's logging into his partner portal, that he knows right away where he is. That's something which, you know, a lot of the partners, as they grow, they might have an investment that they haven't done yet. So this is something I think which is very, very important, is to make it as transparent as possible in these systems. And obviously for the commissions, that's at the end of the day, that's where the partner wants to see what he's getting actually from the vendor. But absolutely, totally with you. We need those tools to make sure that we can keep accelerating for that growth.
Got it. I mean, that's an interesting part to me as well. What I was referring more to is, so your technology, right? The stuff UiPath is offering. And I would assume as a partner, I should have access to your technology to be able to demo it. To build something on it. So is that kind of, it's just there because we are SaaS and here's your user, or?
I mean, I can just talk for UiPath at the moment. I don't want to talk about the other companies that I've worked for. We have a so-called not for resale license. So this is something which is used, and this is something which is free of charge to the partners. You need to, obviously, as you're in pre-sales, you know that you need to know the demo. You need to know the tool. I think, you know, you had John on the last time or two times ago, and he mentioned too, you know, you need to know the product. You need to know that. And you know, there's more products that are coming at UiPath. You know, we went from 3 to over 14 new products, and you need to make sure that these partners are always on the latest. So, you know, we've also gone into the cloud at UiPath, and for that, you need a different instance or process mining. This is also something which is a little different than just doing regular RPA, a little bit of automation. So you need to make sure that your partner is able, and that's the great thing with UiPath that I'm seeing is, you know, we really have that ethos, yeah, to make RPA, to democratize it as much as possible, to make sure that everybody can use it. So there's even a so-called community edition where people can just download it from the UiPath's website and start playing around and start automating. Make it like water, like I said at the beginning. No. Make it like water. It's got to be everywhere.
It's going to be the headline for this episode. Software is like water.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, that makes me happy. Thank you so much, Mark. So, Tim, I would be now ready to conclude a little bit.
Oh, please go ahead.
Okay. So with my words, what I have heard, Mark, from you and what I gathered from the conversation. First of all, in partner management, you are also selling. which I think is great, right? But you need to balance between the big players, so the big partners, and the smaller partners. In that respect, scalability is a really important topic, especially if you're in a hyper-growth market like you guys are. And your recommendation is always look at the whole picture, right? So don't see partner as a silo. You need to see it in the context of your whole strategy. If it comes to partner management, one very important aspect is onboarding, right? Because it's a big deal, because it's mission critical for the success of the company. Tim asks, as always, a tricky question: why do we need partners anyway? Right? And you said, first of all, to scale, right? There's no other way to really scale in these hypergrowth and environments. And as you mentioned, software needs to be like water. And the partners really know the whole picture. So they know where the customers are, the processes, all that stuff, but they also know your solution, your offering, and they can bring everything together. So they are the connector, right? And at the end of the day, it's as simple as you definitely need someone who is implementing your solution. And also, you as a vendor, you would like to focus on the growth of your company, but also on your product offering. And I believe doing that is also creating kind of new opportunities for your partners with a marketplace, for example, right? So give them the authority to extend your existing offering. And I would assume everyone will benefit: the customer, the partner, and the vendor. So we talked about silver, gold, platinum. What's the point, right? And you said it's pretty much related to investments, but also to exposure. So really to see how mature the relationship with that partner is, how much they are investing, and yeah, make it transparent, but also give them a level of exposure. One very interesting topic to me, because Tim, I think, has kind of horrible memories on that, is that you said you should have very specific roles within partner management. For example, people who are more technical orientated, right? Because otherwise you would always call pre-sales and say, could you do this? Could you do that? And it wouldn't feel like, hey, there's a real strategy behind it, right? Which again,
I still cry myself to sleep at times. It was so horrible.
Yeah. I can imagine. And so by doing that, right, so relying on pre-sales and relying maybe on consulting, all that stuff, I would feel like, okay, you don't really have a partner strategy. You try to acquire partners, and you try to do that in a very simple way. You don't want to really make an investment, right? So you're really kind of cost-driven, and worst case, you just started with your business, but you're already asking potential partners to pay money to be part of your network. So I really appreciate what you said. If you would like to establish a partner channel, then please do it the right way and make the investment, right? Because it will pay off at the end of the day. So how to get started and how to identify the right partners for you? Your recommendation was do your own research, right? So look in specific countries, or just figure out who are the players in your kind of business area or market area. And also make sure that you're talking to the strategy consultant companies, right? Because they already interacting with the people on the customer side you would like to get to, right? So the management, the real decision makers. And of course, they also should have some insights into the existing partner landscape or ecosystem, and maybe can make a recommendation. So once you acquired these partners, right, and you onboarded them and all that stuff, part of that should be also plan it out together with the partners. Make it concrete, agree on KPIs, and really try to grow a partnership and build relationships not only from partner management to the partners, but also into the company, I would assume, especially with your sales team and your pre-sales team in some respect. And also give them the tools they need, the transparency they need, make it easy for them to connect with you, to collaborate with you, to see where they are in respect of commissions, bring the learning assets to them in an easy way, which also reflects to me, it is an investment, right? Because you need to establish that infrastructure, you need to have the people to care about the partner. And finally, as a partner manager, don't forget your internal customers. And the first line you said is the sales management. You need to have a real connection and partnership with them, because at the end of the day, selling is a team sport.
Absolutely. I like your resume. When Thank are you, you. Starting?
So aside the fact that this was probably the longest conclusion we ever had on any show, and you already gave feedback, Mark, I hope we didn't miss anything crucial when it comes to partner management.
No, I think the only thing was the technology partnerships. So when I was talking about UiPath, I talked about, I went to Microsoft, for instance, and I looked at their top partners to see what I could take or what I could get in there. So that's the only thing that I would add.
Right. Makes sense.
Perfect. Thanks for that addition. And with that being said, Mark, it has been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us here on this episode. And great input from your side.
Great. Thanks. It was a big honor, guys. I sure remember the time, Jan, when you visited us in Zurich some years back for a startup that you were at. And Tim, it's great to have made the connection. I really appreciate you guys asking. And really am a big fan of your show. And hope that you get a lot more interesting people, not just me, on your show.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Yeah, thank you for that. So, dear listener, if you liked the real-time conclusion from Jan today, or if you liked this general episode and have learned anything, we would really appreciate if you would follow us on LinkedIn and give us maybe a comment or a like on this episode. Also, a rating on Apple Podcasts obviously helps us for visibility and growth. That's what you can give us back if you like this. And with that being said, thanks for tuning in again, and we hope to hear you next time. Bye-bye.